Welcome to Season 2 of Fresh Growth, a podcast by the Western SARE program. That's Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. I'm your host, Steve Elliott, alongside co-host Stacy Clary. Just for background, Western SARE promotes sustainable farming and ranching across the American West through research, education, and communication efforts like this podcast. It is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Fresh Growth introduces producers and agricultural professionals from around the West who are embracing new ways of farming and ranching. They'll tell us about their experiences adopting more sustainable agricultural practices and the challenges and benefits they've seen. Today's guest is Mike Nolan, who farms in the Mancos Valley in southwest Colorado. Mountain Roots Produce provides the local and regional community high-quality and reasonably priced vegetables and has a popular CSA. Mike discusses his commitment to building soil health, a strong local food system, and a profitable business, all while facing challenges brought on by COVID and limited water in the high desert climate.
Well, welcome, Mike. It's really good to talk with you again. I appreciate you taking the time to join us for the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So to start out with, maybe describe where you're at, what you produce, and just a little bit about your operation.
For sure. Our operation is in the Four Corners area. We're in between Cortez and Durango in southwest Colorado. And my fiance and I, on a good water year, raise about 6 acres of row crop vegetable. And on a year like this, where we had limited water, we mainly do about 2 to 3 acres of production. About 30% of that is your classic market garden, high density, high succession, cat tunnel, high tunnel, hoop house kind of stuff. And then the rest of it, we focus on storage crops. So the rest of the field is potatoes, carrots, storage onion, winter squash, garlic, beets, and that kind of stuff. Our general farm marketing wise tends to focus mainly on wholesale. But with COVID this year, we pivoted and we went almost about 80% was going to CSA. We jumped our CSA numbers pretty huge to pivot that market in March and April.
It was just the loss of restaurant business and
It was just loss of restaurants. It was just kind of one of those things where, you know, I got back from National Farmers Union convention in Savannah in early March, and within a day or two, the state was on lockdown, and all our friends' restaurants were starting to close. And on an average year, about 60% of our gross income is coming out of restaurants and front-end retail, so grocery stores. So we kind of looked at each other and we're like, well, we were going to decrease the CSA numbers. and so we decided to go the other way. So we went from about 70 CSA shares. We ended up doing about 175 this year in focusing on that.
How much extra work is that?
Too much. we're not doing it again unless we're absolutely forced to. It was too much work. We were, didn't have enough labor. We were really worried about cash flow, which is why we kind of did it. So we were kind of understaffed. We were on short water. So we were deficit irrigating pretty much everything in order to get by. It was really challenging having, I don't mind dealing with a dozen restaurants, dealing with 175 individual customers. It was challenging to maintain and hit those deliverables every week, for sure. Mm-hmm.
How are the customers getting their boxes? Were you doing deliveries? Were they coming out to you? How did you make that work with 175 different customers?
Yeah, so we had that kind of split. We had a big bulk of that up in Telluride. We had some on-farm pickup here in Mancos. And we actually worked with a nonprofit organization. And this was kind of cool. We did 30 shares to the local hospital. So our local hospital, I think it's Centura at the state level that manages the hospitals in our region, basically threw a bunch of money at the regional hospitals to basically buy down CSA shares. So there's about 100 CSA shares hitting our hospital. We did 30 of those. So the staff and nurses paid basically 50%. Centura paid the other 50%. And we would deliver that through kind of a mediator or a person that would drop it off. But we actually had to change how we were doing our pickups, which that was added more time and kind of more management to it. Usually we do kind of farmer's market style. So even if we have 100 people picking up, we just basically set up this massive booth and it's take one of these, take two of these. There's a sign. People have their kind of freedom of choice. But what we had to do this year is basically pre-bag everything. Mm-hmm. We set up, in Telluride, we set up cones at 6 foot distancing, masks and gloves. Tried to communicate to everyone to like be patient and give space and kind of do it in that manner. So that added a whole kind of other level of labor, getting it up there and delivering it. And for Mancus, we usually set it up in our pack shed and people come in and socialize. And what we ended up doing was taking our mobile cooler, our trailer cooler, parking it on the driveway, pre-bagging everything, having hand sanitizer and signs and all that kind of stuff out there. And we didn't really interact with those customers much at all this summer, which everyone seemed actually pretty okay with. Mm-hmm. So we kind of had to shift it on that. So there was, the earlier question about it was a lot of work. So there's the additional CSA members. And then that we had to basically change the way we generally manage that and added in a bunch of labor and a bunch of time and material. You know, we ordered 4,000 biodegradable plastic bags out of a company in Michigan in order to make it work. And then ordered in about 150 Intercrate crates to be able to individually pack them and stack them and everything. So it was a little hectic. We got it done though. So mm-hmm.
I know it's early to be thinking about next year, but not really, because we're not going to be probably past, you know, COVID by the time the spring rolls around. What's your plan for next spring and next year?
Our plan, I could tell you what we want to do, and then I could tell you what we're probably going to do.
there you go.
What we want to do is almost drop the CSA in its entirety. We're about, this is my 16th year growing. I think it was Mindy's 11th or 12th. We're at a point where we don't need to rely on that model for the upfront cash flow. We're just as comfortable going to our ag lender and, you know, tapping into some money in the beginning of the season in order to get the operation kind of going. So ideally what we'd like to do is drop the CSA, go back to running our market stand and online orders and wholesale orders up in Telluride, and then really focus on kind of move away from the market garden, high succession, high management, and really get back to the kind of storage crop and the big bulk kind of items, and kind of switch back to what we used to do about 8 years ago, which is mainly storage product, and kind of go back to that. What I think is actually going to happen is I think we'll probably still do a small CSA for Mancus. You know, it's a small town, 1,000 people. People really enjoy it. That'll still give us a little bit of cash flow to help us out in the spring. And I actually, my gut feeling is we won't be growing much at all next year because of the water situation and kind of what we're looking at in the future. Our reservoir is super low. The high country is really dry. And the predictions for winter don't look that good. So if anything, we'll really kind of scale back and just kind of end up doing the market garden high density stuff that we don't necessarily want to do, but do it so we can make it through and see what 2022 looks like. That's kind of where we're sitting with everything right now.
Talk about your water situation sort of long-term and where you've been and sort of the unique geography of your region too.
Yeah. So, you know, Colorado is the watershed for the West. It's pretty complicated. Our water starts up in the La Plata Mountains. Our watershed feeds basically the Mancos Valley. It feeds the Mancos River, the Dolores River, and those two rivers feed two reservoirs for storage water that feed basically all of Montezuma County, some of Dolores County, and a little bit of La Plata County. Our reservoir for us is small. It really helps us, but when it gets low, it's really hard to bring it back. I always give the analogy, it's kind of like a GPA, you know, it's like you get good grades for years and then you get one C or 1D, and then it's going to take you another couple classes or a couple years to get back, build up your numbers back up again. And that's kind of the position we keep on getting stuck in. We keep on having these drought years, which knock our reservoir down, which knock our water allotments down. And then it can take years to kind of climb back to where, to some sense of normalcy. We do have two forms of water we function off here. We have our adjudicated water, and that right on my property goes back to the 1880s. So everyone in the valley has some sort of, you know, state adjudicated water right that they function off. When that runs out, we go to our storage water, which is Bureau of Reclamation, federal water, and that's managed by our local conservancy district. But depending on what it is, like this year, we had a 48% allotment of our storage water. So we basically had to function at basically the smallest amount of water to make it run as long as possible. And it just takes a lot of coordination. I would say that I spent 2 to 3 hours a day, 7 days a week, sometimes longer, just coordinating water usage off our lateral, working with the ditch riders on the other ditches, and working with the conservancy to see what's going on in the valley in its entirety to make sure that we had enough to push our crop as much as we could. And saying that, we still lost water August 20th this year. And then so we ended up having to clean up some of our bigger crops, like our storage carrots and a few other things on domestic water, which is something we don't like to do, but we had to. And we spent about $2,000 on domestic water in about a 5-week period in order to carry those crops over. It's tricky. It's complicated, for sure. We could probably do a whole podcast on just on the water.
It's a very challenging area to be farming in, and you say you've been doing it for about 16 years. How did you wind up in that area to farm in, and what keeps you motivated to continue?
I ended up in this area. So I started off pretending to farm with a friend of mine, Sarah Wiedeker, who farms up in Maine now, just out in between Davis, Woodland, Dixon, and Winters outside of Sacramento. I ended up going to Santa Cruz and doing the Center for Agroecology internship program there, or apprenticeship there for a year, was a second year apprentice. And then kind of looked at California and was like, okay, I like California. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to afford a home. I don't think I can ever afford ag land. And my friends that were running successful operations, I really admired them, but I didn't want to do what they would do, which was they were going to 5, 6, 7 markets a week. They were having to do about 5 to 10 acres of production in order to kind of get to the point where they were profitable. So I visited a friend out in Southwest Colorado and just kind of moved here. Land was relatively cheap. The market seemed like they were about 15 years behind what California was doing, or what some of the other saturated markets in other parts of the Northeast and Northwest were doing. So that's kind of why I chose it. I really like the location. I really like winter, which is something I never really experienced much in California. Like, we actually get a break. Mother Nature says you can't farm right now, which I actually really appreciate. So kind of took all that and moved here. Ended up finding a piece of property about 6-7 years ago. And the markets have kind of started to catch up to what it seems like in other parts of the country, but there's still just a lot of untapped kind of market share and untapped production here. You know, in our peak, when we're running about 6 acres of production, we're the second or third largest operation for about 100-mile radius. It's pretty uncommon around here to have that sort of vegetable farming. Everything around here is alfalfa, general pasture, cow-calf operation, and then winter wheat and a few other crops, dry beans. So yeah, and I really like it. I really like the community here, and that's what's kind of keeping me. I think if I didn't love my community and I wasn't engaged in it, we would really consider selling and moving somewhere else where the water was more stable, for sure.
Your website is really good. How much of a marketing vehicle is that for your farm?
It's it's really important. And I will put this disclaimer. I don't do anything on the website. Mindy does all of that. I'm not really even allowed to post on our Instagram or Facebook. I just kind of stay away from the social media thing. Mm-hmm. She does all that, and it's really phenomenal. Her pictures are gorgeous. The layout's gorgeous. The online store is phenomenal. It's been great. I mean, a few years ago, I never thought like, oh, I was like, well, what's kind of the point of having a website? You know, we're running a few acre farm. We know all of our accounts are our friends, all of our CSA members we know personally. What's the point? And then she started to build it out and really put blogs up there and put up the photos and had a good social media presence. And then last year, we were like, okay, let's just see what this looks like. Let's do a sponsored Facebook ad, see what that does. And with two $60 ads, we sold about $6,500 of product on our online store in about a 2-week period. And that wouldn't have happened if there wasn't all these gorgeous pictures and narratives and blog posts and stuff on there. So I think it's a great vehicle. And especially we're glad we did that last year, because this year with that, it really helped us to connect with those CSA members and really find those individuals that wanted to support us in the times of COVID and everything kind of going on.
So you grew to 175 members and you feel connected, then you say you are going to continue some of the CSA next year. Do you feel that the majority of those 175 would remain with you if you wanted to do that, regardless of COVID?
I would think the majority would definitely do that. Majority being probably 60 to 70% of them. I think that's a really great question. I think that's one thing that I'm seeing a lot of people start to talk about now, as everyone's kind of slowing down on the back end of this season, is I'm curious to see, with all the pivoting all the producers did, and then all the, you know, people, we were basically asking the consumer to see our importance and focus on us for the last 10 years. And then all of a sudden COVID hits, and then we're just flooded with interest. I'm really curious to see what portion of that actually maintains down the line. Was this a temporary kind of gut reaction to COVID and food security, or was this an actual change that the consumers have made as a whole to focus on local and regional agriculture and you know, buying products directly from producers? So yeah, I don't really know. I would think that the majority would. That I'm really curious to see what the winter holds and what kind of goes into it. I mean, the perspective I keep is that when COVID hit, sure, restaurants closed down, sure, you know, people were out of work, but there was a little bit of initial stimulus. There was a little bit of initial things coming in. And if we don't kind of have those kind of support structures going into, if this is still going next spring, I don't necessarily think the consumers are necessarily going to have the money to support us in the same way they did last year. And it's something that other small businesses have noticed. We have a raft company in town, Alpaca Raft, that does pack rafting, and they have the same kind of thing. They saw the two worst months on record. Then they saw the three biggest months on record for their business. And they're curious, where's the middle ground? Where's the balance? You know, if people don't have income and still don't are out of work, what is their business going to look like down the line? Right. So I think that's a really great question. And honestly, I don't know. I really hope that the consumers kind of stick with us. I know we have our core group of individuals that we've been working with for 5, 6, 7, 8 years that are going to stick with us almost no matter what. But other than that, I'm curious to see how it actually plays out going into the 2021 season.
And you worked, if I remember correctly, you worked on a resource that wasn't in your area previously, kind of a local food directory. Has that been used? Are people accessing it?
Yeah, I haven't even looked at it in about 3 months. I got a little busy. Yeah, so a few of us, who was it? It was myself and Mindy, a few other growers in the region, and then we got members from Farm Bureau, Rocky Mountain Farmers Union, Colorado State University, some other advocacy organizations. And in about a 4-week period, we got a domain, southwestproducers.org. got about 60 local producers to upload pictures, narratives, links, bios, all sorts of other stuff. And we just kind of threw it out there to see what would happen. The engagement numbers, looking on them through the Squarespace website, were pretty phenomenal. We were getting a few hundred unique hits a day. Multiple county commissioners and other groups shared the website out. And though we haven't done anything with it recently, the initial feedback I got from about a half a dozen producers who are on there is that, you know, they were selling out their CSAs exceptionally quickly, their online ordering, their websites were getting a lot of unique hits once that website got launched and a few weeks after. And a lot of folks were able to sell out of pre-orders on like quarters, wholes, and halves on protein, and then also run through their inventory on frozen meats too. So it ended up working out really well. We're hoping to, once everything kind of quiets down a little bit in December or January, sit down with the core group of people and see what do we want to do with it and see how we want to move forward with it. Because it could be a great resource for everyone around here, but it was definitely never my intention to manage it. I don't have that kind of time. So we want to figure out a good group of people or see if we can find a little bit of funding to kind of throw at it to see how it could shake out even further. Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned Mindy a couple of times, and on the website, it talks about how she came to farming. That's a good story. How did she come to farming?
How did she come to farming?
Yeah.
So the story goes, she was up in Telluride working at a law office and basically was about to sign up for a CSA and then said, well, forget this. I'm just going to quit my job and go work for the farm. And ended up meeting some great friends there and worked there for two seasons and then started her own operation on her parents' land up in Ridgeway, just outside of Telluride. Yeah. And then I convinced her to move down here. We classically, you know, we didn't meet on like farmersonly.com or anything, but it was classic, like, you know, meeting at the ag conference. yeah. And that's how she got her kind of start in it. I always love those stories because everyone's story is so different about how they ended up in it, especially a lot of us, like, you know, zero generation, first generation kind of producers. But mm-hmm. Yeah, she's got a great story behind it.
Yeah. It's interesting that, because we talk to a lot of, doing this podcast, we talk to a lot of second, third generation farmers who are taking over a family operation and trying to take it in a new direction or do something different or, you know, evolve. And that presents its own challenges, but coming at it with, you know, no family land, no family history is its own challenges as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So when you talk to your contemporaries, especially those who have done it the other way, who have come from families, you know, what do you see as the common ground or the differences where, you know, what have you noticed?
I think the common ground that I find, like I do a lot of work with Rocky Mountain Farmers Union, and there's a ton of members in that are multi-generational, centennial farms. And I think the commonality, the common ground that they see within us and we see within them is that in general, that none of this has ever really been easy. It's always a challenge. Every year is challenging in its own unique way. We're all, whether you've been doing it for four generations or for two seasons, water's an issue, climate's an issue, weather's an issue, all that kind of stuff. And I think when I talk to some of my friends that are doing that kind of like succession kind of stuff, multi-generational farms or marrying into operations and that kind of stuff, there's definite differences in what we have to worry about and what they have to worry about. You know, I wish I had more land that I can manage what I have, and individuals that are inheriting 400, 600, 800 acres, you know, they have a lot of different concerns of taxes on that land and, you know, all sorts of other, you know, years of debt and all sorts of other things. The big focus, I think, for beginning producers, and this is where I think a little bit of the difference is our big issue, which is why we did the CSA for so long, is infrastructure. You know, it's a lot of these old ranches, you know, they've got big hay barns, they've got, you know, big tractors sitting around, they've got combines sitting around. Sure, they need maintenance, they need work. It'd be great to upgrade them. But a lot of the young guns that are coming into this, having land or not, you know, you have to build your wash station from scratch. You don't own a tractor. You have to build out all your infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You might be lucky enough to get a property that already has some irrigation infrastructure on it. And I think that's kind of one of the kind of differences that I kind of see. And that's been our big thing we've been dealing with, is we just need the proper infrastructure in order to not just break even, but be profitably annually.
Your firm has a strong emphasis on building soil health. What does that look like for you? And then also talking about maybe farms that have been in your area for a longer time, how do they view the work that you're doing?
Yeah, we do have a large focus on soil health. That's kind of been our prime thing. Like, we're not certified organic. You know, we're basically organic, but we're not. So we don't tend to be like, oh, we're an organic farm. Our thing is soil health, crop rotation, education around that. The way that we kind of do it is through, basically, we're doing it through cover cropping. I mean, we have a really short growing window and a really short growing season. So we try to keep everything covered as much as we can. We try to use as much minimal tillage practices as we can. We still till. We're still in an annual cropping system. So we definitely have to do things. We still disturb soil. We try to do spring and fall soil samples and tests to see where we're at. Where we're at right now is, when I bought the property, it was about 1.5% organic matter. We're sitting at about 4% across the board now. One thing we're trying to actually get away from is we're trying to get away from drip tape. We find that to be, in our climate, actually not that beneficial to soil health, especially when we're in such massive droughts. And we also don't like all the plastic waste that we produce with it. We're trying to figure out, the most challenging aspect of it is the high density, high succession area. How do you maintain soil health when you have to double or triple crop on something on an annual basis? We don't really have access to compost in our region. We have limited water. We don't have necessarily enough land to pull large tracts out of production for a long period of time. So that's been kind of challenging, which is part of the reason why we want to shift away from CSA too, is we kind of want to get away from that weekly succession, turnover, replants, fertilize kind of thing that we're a little bit stuck in right now. Mm-hmm. And in general, a lot of the locals, they enjoy it. I think a lot of them are really intrigued by it. I've got a neighbor who's fourth generation, runs cow-calf operation, probably irrigates about 300 to 400 acres, if not more, in the valley. And, you know, we talk on the fence line, and he tries all sorts of neat stuff. Like, he tries to plant in turnips and plant in other cover crops and kind of messes around and experiments with things. And I think they're more curious than anything. The old time locals have been kind of appreciative of some of us that have kind of moved here. I think part of it too is our mentality. I think if I were to come here and basically be like, the way you farm is wrong and the way I farm is right, then it wouldn't work out.
Right. You don't make a lot of friends that way.
No, you don't. You know, and there's so much in the world of agriculture where everything is so good or bad, black or white, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I really think that the solutions are in the gray area. Solutions are kind of in the middle ground, and approaching the community and the folks that have been here, whatever their practices are, and approaching it with a degree of humility has really kind of helped. And another thing that I've tried to do personally, and I know a couple of the other younger guys have tried to do, is we try to plug into the different organizations around here. We try to plug into the farm advocacy, whether that's Farm Bureau or Rocky or Cattlemen's. I'm the president of the conservation district around here. I have other friends that sit on the conservancy district, which is the lake managers and the water board. You know, folks sit on the FSA board. So we try to like kind of plug in that kind of manner and show that we really care about it and we are involved. We're not just here temporarily or here to, I don't know, just be weird.
And you mentor young farmers as well. Is that right? How does that work? And when did you start that?
So I started that in, I think it was about 10 years ago now. So I ended up, this is part of the story I didn't tell earlier. So I moved to Southwest Colorado and farmed for about 5 months and lost all my money, lost all my mental health, and just left. Like the first farm I tried starting totally failed. Ended up moving to Jacksonville, Florida, of all places, and bumming around the Southeast, working on farms, doing construction jobs, kind of doing whatever. Found my way back, farmed in New Mexico with some buddies for a year or two. And then it was kind of calling around. I wanted to move back to the Four Corners area. Made a couple calls and heard that Beth Lachelle from the old Fort in Hesperus and Darren Parmenter, the CSU extension agent, were kind of applying for funding to start an incubator program. And so I talked to them, called them, we chatted about it. And I was like, well, what if I was just the trial incubator for a couple of years? Like, I'll help you build the fence, build the infrastructure. We'll dial in the irrigation. We'll figure out the layout. We'll figure out the programs, all the nitty gritty. So that's basically what I did. I moved back up here. I was the trial incubator for a few years, basically helping them set up the program. And then we started to bring in farmers as I transitioned out to the property I'd bought. So I was super grateful for that opportunity because I wouldn't have been able to move back here and do what I'm doing now without it. And right now that program is still in existence. We're just launched the applications for it. And we actually started another program on the side. So we have the incubator program, which individuals can lease land, take classes, have mentorship for a year at a time. It's an annual application. Eighth of an acre, quarter acre, half an acre, depending on what your history is, what you want to do, what your skill set is, how much you want to learn, where you want to go. And that's been really successful. It's turned out half a dozen farms in the region that are still in existence and are now successful on their own. Great. It's also, you know, we view this as a win too. It's also the individuals that it didn't work out for. They didn't go and lease land and go into a bunch of debt and really try this. And then it didn't work out for them for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. So even though our success rate, I think, is like in the 80s, we view it as 100% success rate because we help these individuals try it out, but not burn themselves out financially doing it. And then a few years ago, a few other individuals out there started a thing called the Farmer in Training Program, which is a lead in to the incubator program. And what that does, it's a summer-long program which pays individuals to farm. So you come into the old fort, you have established markets, you have a CSA, you have a country store that you run, and you get paid to do it, basically. And so we have 3 to 4 individuals do that. Some of those individuals become incubators. Some of those individuals go out to work on other farms. Some of them kind of stay in the area and do food advocacy. So that's really been kind of neat. Yeah. And I like mentoring. I think, you know, we had a call with a friend of ours up in the Carbondale area, Aspen area, yesterday. And I really love talking to these individuals that are just starting out. There's so much that they don't need to reinvent the wheel on that. There's so many mistakes I have made that I'll gladly tell them about. And it's just, I think it's just really nice. Like, we're pretty open with our farm. If anybody wants to look at our books, if anybody, you know, I'll send you our whole order sheets for all our seed. I'll tell you wherever we get our packaging. I'll give you our price lists on all this kind of stuff. So I think that's some of the most challenging stuff when you're starting out is you don't know where to buy your plastic bags. You don't know where to order this. You know, who do you order drip tape and irrigation fittings off? Like, how do you communicate with chefs? All that kind of stuff. So I still really enjoy it. It's kind of fun. I've got a neighbor right here, Duke Jackson, who's in his second year. And we probably talk on the fence line a couple times a week and just chat about what's going on and what he's doing, what I'm doing. And yeah, it's really lovely. I like the mentorship aspect of this.
Mm-hmm. It's really valuable. I was talking with another farmer training program, and they expressed that they saw a pretty large increase in people interested in the farmer training programs since COVID, as people were looking for a different kind of employment or had the time to go through training program. Are you seeing that as well?
We just launched the application, so I'll know that in a couple of weeks, but I would assume that's kind of the case.
So we usually end with asking, what advice would you give to somebody starting out, especially if their focus is on sustainability and they're just beginning, what kind of advice would you give?
Oh boy. A couple things that I tend to give advice on is, first off, don't quit your day job if you don't have to. That was really valuable to me. I still worked. I was a delivery person for a bakery for 3 years as I was getting things going. It can take a while to build out the operation to where it's profitable. So there's nothing bad or no judgment in having to have a winter job or having to maintain a job while you're trying to do it. It's really challenging, but you will kind of get there. One other piece of advice that was given to me, and I still pass on other individuals, is in your first year, kind of don't treat it as your first year. Treat it as year zero. Really focus on that infrastructure build out. Really focus on the markets. Really focus on what you want to do. Don't try to do too much. And really kind of build it out. I think what I've observed with incubator programs and with people starting up is that there's this tendency to, you know, read Jean-Martin Fortier's book and then go and start an operation. And just in your first year, you want to be making this amount of money. You want to have all these tools, do all this stuff. And it's, you can't really go from being, from bussing tables at the restaurant to being the head chef in like a 6 month period. Like, there's having patience with it and moving forward. I think that's a really good perspective to have. One of my favorite mentors, Jim Leap, out in California. He managed the Santa Cruz program. I love him and his wife, Polly, dearly. And one of the greatest things he ever said was, you know, on one of our first days, this is like 2006 in Santa Cruz. And he was like, I've been farming, I forget at that point, for like 20 something years. He's like, I've only done it 25 times. Or like, you know, I've been farming for 25 years, I've only done it 25 times. And it's, our industry is all very different from every other industry. You know, if you're a chef at a restaurant, if you screw up a plate, 5 minutes later, you're going to have that same plate going out and you can make up the difference.
Yep.
You know, you have, for farming, you have a hailstorm come in, you have something, you missed a market opportunity. You're going to have to probably wait 12 months to kind of get that back. So kind of being patient with it all and being okay with failure, being okay with challenging and not trying to do too much out of the gate is really, I think, really, really, really valuable. And then leaning on others, you know, I think some of the most successful farmers I know have never lost that initial humility they kind of had. Like, they still, you know, 20 years in, 30 years into their operation, you know, they're still texting or calling their friends to be like, I've got this issue, what do I do? I've got this market challenge, what do I do? Mm-hmm. And really kind of being open to that. Yeah. Those are kind of the initial pieces of advice that have really kind of helped me kind of get through this.
Yeah. They seem like valuable pieces of advice. I like the analogy of the dishwasher to chef. That just takes a while. I mean, these things take a while. To learn a craft, and this is a craft.
Could I give you one more other cheesy analogy, and you guys can cut it or leave it on this one? This is my new one that I've been running with. The other piece of advice I would give beginning farmers, especially considering most of them are coming into the kind of high density market garden style stuff, is this is, I call this the taco truck analogy. So you move to an area and you look around and there's 20 taco trucks. Why would you start a taco truck? And so in saying that, I'm basically saying that, like, sure, there's already 20 small market gardens around here. What are you going to do to be different and unique from everybody else? Mm-hmm. Because I'm noticing a little bit of the failure and a little bit of the burnout is everyone is trying to do the exact same model kind of stacked on each other. Everyone's looking at, you know, back in my day, I'm only 39, but 15, 20 years ago, everyone was doing, Elliot Coleman was everyone is looking at Elliot for advice in his books. And now Jean-Martin Fortier and a few others. And so I'm just noticing everyone kind of doing the same thing. And so try to be unique, try to do something a little bit different, you know, still have your food truck, but maybe you don't sell tacos, you know, maybe you have a, you know, Thai food, or maybe you're doing sliders. Like, you can still still be in that world, but do something a little bit different that could give you a financial edge, a market edge, or whatever you might need.
That's very good advice, and we'll definitely keep the taco truck analogy in there because that was some good advice.
And now I'm hungry. So,
right.
Right. Well, thank you, Mike. This was a really good chance to sit down and talk with you, and you had a lot of good advice for people, and definitely a good story about your history and then how the last year has gone for you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate both of you taking time. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, we enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Fresh Growth. We hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information on Western SER grants and our learning resources, visit westernser.org.